All right, everybody. Welcome, as always, to our FOMC panel for June 2025. Now, friends, if you were hoping for a quiet summer, I'm sorry to disappoint because things are really heating up the world abroad, as we've all seen in the news. Now, topically, we've got softening GDP, sticky inflation, a nervous bond market, housing fatigue, and the ever-reassuring backdrop of geopolitical tension. So thank you all for coming to today's panel, where the vibes are uncertain at best and the yield curve doesn't want to talk about it. So I'm going to run through, as always, today's panelists, starting with Joseph Wang. Always love having him here, our go-to Fed guy. As many of you know, he headed the trading at the Fed's Open Markets Desk. Has a great introductory book on central banking called Central Banking 101, the CIO at Monetary Macro, and has really good weekly videos on macro every week on YouTube. Welcome back, Joseph.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I always enjoy being on this panel, and I always learn a lot.
As do I, Joseph. Thanks for coming. Next, we've got another frequent flyer and friend of the spaces, Last Bear Standing, an expert on markets, and he writes regularly in his weekly Substack about monetary policy, as well as individual names that he's looking into. If you're not subscribed to that Substack, go do that. Welcome back, Last Bear. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, guys. Good to be with you guys as usual for FOMC. Looking forward to what Powell has to say about these exciting times that we live in. So looking forward to the discussion.
Next, we've got Bob Elliott, the CIO at Unlimited Funds, former IC at Bridgewater, and also the PM of ticker HFND. He brings vast knowledge and non-reactionary takes, and that's very refreshing, especially when we've got so much turmoil everywhere. And it just seems like every time you click on a link, it is fearful and scary. Bob, welcome back. Excited to have your takes today.
Thanks so much for having me. I was thinking today what it would be like if I failed at my job for 50 straight months and decided to do nothing in response.
Of course, we've also got our go-to leading volatility expert, our man, Jem Carson of Kai Volatility. Always love having you here, Jem, and I know I'm going to have a lot of questions about volatility and flows in equities during all of the wild rides we've been having. Welcome back, Jem.
How's it going, guys? Good to be back. I will say it's like every time we hop on, I'm like, it couldn't get crazier. There couldn't be more weird macro things going on, and every time it is even wilder. So plenty to talk about today. Looking forward to it.
Without fail, Jem, you're absolutely right. And we're going to kind of jump into the thick of it. I want to start off with a little bit of macroeconomic framing and maybe touch a little bit on GDP. So kind of starting off here, core PCE inflation was 3.6% in quarter one, and headline CPI remains near 2.4%. And some are actually voicing concerns that the Fed is late in policy shift. And Joseph, in your recent Markets Weekly, you touch on this as well, noting numerous policy changes that are sort of, as you said, frozen in place, with the Fed not entirely certain how to react or how to move forward for the most part. Can you tell us here, starting us off with some more context there, are those two cuts that were currently projected going to happen this year?
So thanks for the intro. So I think we should take a step back and, as you mentioned, to level set a little bit. So the Fed is basically frozen in motion right now. Now, Powell has been worried about the outlook, and he's saying that there's a lot of things happening in the markets from policy shifts, and he's not quite sure how the economy will react. We have big changes in regulatory policy, in immigration policy, fiscal policy coming around, and of course, trade policy. And so there's a lot of cross currents. And the Fed has basically committed to being late. They don't want to do anything preemptively because there's so much uncertainty. They want to wait until the data turns. Now, this is a little bit different in how they usually react. As we recall, last year, they saw the data kind of heading towards the wrong way and acted preemptively and cut 50 basis points last year. So one other new thing that they've been worrying about is inflation expectations that Chair Powell referenced explicitly in a recent speech. So according to traditional, you know, central banking operating procedure, when we have these, let's say an oil price shock or a tariff shock, these are one-time changes in the price level rather than changes in inflation, which is the rate of change for prices. And you're supposed to look through this. So usually the Fed shouldn't really be caring about this. But when you have inflation expectations de-anchoring, as some surveys suggest they are, then they can't really take that. They can't really look past that. So right now, between now and the last time that the Fed had their meeting, we've had Trump kind of do a big pivot on trade policy, and inflation expectations come down gradually around to where they were pre-Liberation Day. And at the same time, inflation data has come in softer than expected. If you look at headline PCE, which is what the Fed targets, it's, you know, it's like 2.1% year over year, and that's pretty close to target and could go back up later on in the year. And if you look at the labor market, there are signs of deterioration. We have continuing claims moving to multi-year highs. And as we saw in the Wall Street Journal yesterday as a front page story, it seems like new entrants in the labor market are having a more difficult time finding jobs. So if you have a softening labor market and inflation very close to where you want it to be, usually you would expect the Fed to cut, and inflation expectations are cooperating with that. So I tend to think that the Fed is a little bit late. And so that's we'll find out more about what they do today. So today is a special FOMC. It's a quarterly one, so we get their dot plot, so we get to have more insight into how they're thinking about the future. So that's what I'd be looking for today, to see what the dot plot is and see how Chair Powell is digesting all this, especially developments on geopolitics, which I know it's really hard to say how that will turn out, but it's not good.
Absolutely. And a lot of commentary there, Joseph. Thank you so much. A lot of those topics we're going to break down in turn, but just kind of here real quick as well on this notion of, you know, staying the course, no changes yet. Bob, you recently posted a short video as well discussing holding policy, saying, quote, with UE low and stable and inflation still elevated, holding policy steady is the right choice. Tariff and Middle East conflict risks make the choice even clearer. So I'm curious what you mean by that. Is holding policy absolutely the right choice? Are we kind of going down the right trajectory here?
Well, I think from a market participant's perspective, maybe the right choice isn't necessarily what matters. And what really matters is, what are they likely to do, or more likely to do than not? And I think, you know, for many of the reasons that Joseph lays out, you know, the Fed is kind of stuck here. Like, they don't know what kind of inflationary pressures are going to emerge in the near term as a function of the geopolitical conflict and the tariff policy. And, you know, preemptively easing into a rising inflationary environment, or running easy monetary policy in a rising inflationary environment, is what burned them just a few years ago. And so it makes sense that they're a bit hesitant on that side. And on the flip side, when you look at the growth story, I think the sort of straight down the middle look at the unemployment rate basically adds up to, you know, we've had flat unemployment for almost a year now at roughly these rates. And so it's not like there's a lot of urgency from an unemployment rate perspective to engage in aggressive or meaningful cuts. If that starts to change more significantly, then they probably would start to sort of ease off on the inflation concerns and respond a bit more aggressively on the employment concerns. But so far what's happened is, you know, labor markets have remained pretty stable. And while we are seeing some softness in certain measures, it's also been met with softness in labor supply, which has kept the labor markets roughly neutral. And so there's not a lot of urgency on that side of the mandate to start to cut either. And so you put that all together and it's, you know, wait and see mode. And it's probably, you know, in an environment of very difficult circumstances, it's probably the main justifiable path that they can take.
Thank you, Bob. So a little bit on inflation here, just as a broader topic. Janet Yellen said today, and it kind of ties back into the tariff conversation that's obviously been ongoing this entire time, but that notwithstanding, Yellen was quoted today as saying that Trump's tariffs will drive inflation above 3% year over year. However, some have noted that inflation's trajectory itself is still convincingly trending downward. Les Baer, I'd love your take before we punt this one around the panel. Does the evidence suggest a continuing of cooling off with inflation? And how accurate is Yellen's comment here, as loaded of a question as that may be?
Yeah, well, I'd say first on the Yellen point, I think there's probably an element of actual analysis and also an element of politics in it to some degree in terms of whether or not she agrees with tariff policy broadly. I'd say that it is true, I think, by most measures that the inflationary story has continued to decline. I think that there's been concerns around tariffs now. More recently, there's concerns around the rise in oil prices. But we have that shelter component that continues to sort of lag where what we see generally in real-time markets. The housing market overall seems to have weakened somewhat substantially this year, with that sort of likely spreading into sort of rental vacancies as well to some degree. So I think the situation here is kind of what Bob and Joseph described, which is that there's a lot of different things tugging in different directions, but there isn't one clear thing that sort of supersedes everything else. So is the labor market weakening? Yes. But has that been occurring for the past 2.5 years? Also, yes, and it doesn't appear to be accelerating. You have the inflationary perspectives, which I think are more sort of projections as opposed to what we've seen so far in real-time data. But you don't, I think that the fact that the Fed was very much behind the curve, the fact that, as Bob mentioned at the outset, you know, they haven't fulfilled their mandate in, you know, something like 4 or 5 years, I think that that weighs into the calculus. And at the same time, when you have the president who's sort of continuously calling directly for rate cuts, there's almost a natural bias towards not doing that just out of, you know, the impression of sort of keeping it apolitical. And so I think that they're kind of in a wait and see mode till there's something that clearly takes the cake as the defining factor that's going to move rates. So the good thing for them is that the markets are not anticipating that and sort of, or not anticipating a rate cut or a rate move. And so everyone's sort of in line in the sort of wait and see mode. And so I think that's what we're going to do.
Thank you, Last Baer. Now, to kind of go back, we might flop a little bit between GDP and inflation here before we move on. The latest Bureau of Economic Analysis data shows, back to that topic of quarter one GDP, falling 0.2%, which many are speculating, including the BEA, that's driven by a surge in imports, weaker government outlays, while private domestic demand grew around 2.5%. So I'm curious, Jem, from your point of view, is this kind of a misleading headline number, or is policy clearly missing the mark here?
Look, I think everybody here highlighted an important point, that it is muddy. It's clear as mud right now. And I think there are reasons for that we understand. There was a implementation of tariffs that were then quickly withdrawn and then extended for 90 days. I mean, if that doesn't cause a lot of take what is otherwise a smooth kind of curve on GDP and growth and employment and inflation and cause it to zigzag, I don't know what does. A 90-day kind of wait and see on the tariffs pulls forward demand. I mean, the reason that was instituted was to allow companies, you could argue that there are other reasons, but to, at the very least, to allow companies to prepare. And so there was obviously a pull forward of demand in some ways. In the meantime, we've also started cutting all immigration in the U.S. We've gone from a number over $2 million people immigrating to the U.S. per year or more, 2 to 2.5, to zero. That is a huge change. You're taking over 1% growth in the employment and the labor supply, and you're just taking it off the table. All of these things are big, massive changes, never mind the big, beautiful bill, which is yet to pass, but has massive implications if and when it does. So I think to sit here and to look at past data for 1 month or 2 months is the wrong approach. I really, really think that if you're hanging on the last CPI and the last employment number and you're saying, oh, employment's employment's strong and inflation is weak, I think you're missing the point. These are big macro shifts that are happening. These are things that we've been talking about now for years on here, and they are extensions of what we're seeing. They are not a turn back. There are questions in January, would this go to a much more kind of supply side model? Again, the Fed has not been able to come into the fray. The 10-year continues to kind of grind in the wrong direction. And so given that we don't have clarity on tariffs, and I think it's fair to say that we're not going back to the tariffs we were at, right? We can talk about how high those tariffs are, how high they're not. We continue to go down the path, which we've talked about for 4 or 5 years, of continued global conflict. You can isolate Israel, Iran, if you want, as like a one-off deal. It is not. This is part of a broader trend towards global conflict. We have a decentralization of power, and the Fed is at the heart of that. The Fed cannot, they are in a box, and they're unable to control what is otherwise, a stagflationary type situation. So my view is, if we're going to just sit here and digest CPI, and the last CPI and the last unemployment, you know, that's how we got to transitory 1.0. That's how we got to transitory 2.0, transitory 3.0. I don't know how many more times you have to say inflation's dead and then realize that it's not. So I am, color me skeptical. I think the Fed sees that. I think the Fed is also, to Joseph's point, very much aware 4 or 5 years in now that that they have been on the wrong side of this again, again, again. And they have to be more cautious with inflation. They cannot assume that it's dead, especially given those inflationary expectations that they're seeing across kind of polls. And so I think they are very hesitant, understandably, to move in that direction. I think that's probably right. I disagree. Everybody I talk to thinks they're behind the curve and they need to stimulate sooner. I actually think that there is much more under the hood than people expect. That's been the case every time the last 4 years. Every time I get in the situation, I'm the lone person talking about inflation again. I know it's a good trade. And it's a good trade because of the structural causes. What's underneath the hood, every single trend that's happening now points to a secular increase in inflation. And we can talk about cyclical slowdowns. That's the game of the last 40 years. We could get a cyclical slowdown that could control inflation. That'll be fine. But that does not change the secular realities of the policy, the global conflict, all the things that we're seeing. So that's where I stand on this.
Thank you, Jim. Now back to kind of tickle this GDP topic within the inflation broader topic. The BEA also noted, that rising imports, especially those in drugs, durables, and silver, subtracted almost 5 percentage points from GDP. And so even though we've touched on this notion before, I'm curious, might this be front-loading ahead of tariffs, or does it signal a deeper shift in consumer behavior? Last Bear, I'd love your take here.
Well, I think it's important first just to remember that you're subtracting imports out of it or net imports out of it because that's showing up elsewhere, whether that's in investment in inventories, whether that's in consumption. So it's not just that more imports are going to lower your GDP number. It's that you're sort of normalizing for otherwise higher GDP consumption, consumption or investment or inventory build. So I think that's like an important point to make on that front. I think that there were signs of weakness in consumption spending in the last quarter. I think that, we saw yesterday, I think the retail sales were pretty weak. It's hard to look at monthly numbers on that sort of thing, especially on month over month basis, just because there can be a good amount of variability in that. So it's something where I haven't seen a total collapse in retail spending. Things look generally sort of in line with how they have been over the past year or so. But at the same time, if you look back at prior
recessions, oftentimes it's not necessarily retail spending that's the key factor. Oftentimes it's things like fixed capital investment, whether that's residential real estate or business investment, that's more of a swing factor in actual sort of consumption. Unless you have a big recession or a great, you know, like 2008, there was a big decline in consumption. But if you look back at 2000, really, you didn't see much move at all in terms of actual consumption spending. So I think that one thing that we should keep in mind is those other factors, especially I'm looking at residential real estate, what's happening there with supply demand, which was really sort of way out of whack in sort of a seller's favor for some time now, really flipping the other way. And we see that in home builder confidence hitting sort of new lows for this cycle. We see that in home starts that came out recently and even prices in a lot of the hot markets now starting to really roll over for the second time after the first sort of leg down back in 2022. So things like that, business investment, obviously we have positive developments in terms of data center and AI tech development. But if you think about what size that is relative to residential real estate, for example, it's actually a pretty small percentage. So if those sort of cyclical cycles start to roll over, then I think that that's something to watch from sort of a broad GDP perspective.
Thank you, Last Bear. So kind of last thing on this topic specifically, Bob, you recently posted as well that it's pretty unlikely that the goods specifically impacted by tariffs are keeping up their trend of disinflation for long. Can you first tell us what you meant by that and kind of what is the nuance here?
Well, I think there is, taking a step back, you know, tariffs have been in place, or elevated tariffs have been in place for a couple months now. There's been some volatility, but you know, they've been in place. I think people are looking at things like CPI and saying, okay, so where's the price impact? Because at a big picture level, CPI in the last couple months has been soft. And I think one of the things when you, so is it that somehow tariffs are deflationary in aggregate, which, you know, really doesn't make a lot of sense given that, you know, that some goods are clearly going to go up in price as a function of them. You know, so there is an argument that is made by some that says basically tariffs are aggregate deflationary because some prices go up, which means forces other prices to go down and economic activity falls. I think when you look under the hood, there's some real questions about whether, you know, the measurement of inflation in things like CPI is really capturing the respective impacts of the tariff flow through. You have things, I mean, just simple things in CPI like used and new vehicles, which if you look at the reported numbers from, you know, the car manufacturers or Manheim, et cetera, look like they have some signs of rising prices. And at the same time, you look at CPI and it doesn't show up there. And so that chart that I posted basically showed that if you look at the sort of tariff, the likely tariff impacted goods and services, they actually look like they've been deflating since last year. And that just like doesn't pass the common sense test. And so what's happening there, you know, the skeptical person might say, oh, look, it's probably taking some time to be reflected in their measurement of prices. The more conspiracy theorists might say they're trying to suppress the impact of these things. I think that's probably not true, but the basic point is like, and this connecting it back to the Fed, that's what we really care about in terms of our policy. I think it raises questions about whether we really understand what the total through of the impact is of tariffs to domestic prices. And the Fed will look at this at these numbers so far and not say, oh my gosh, it's great, inflation's dead. You know, we don't have to worry about it. They'll say, ooh, I still don't know what the impact of the tariffs are. And so therefore that makes me even more hesitant to do much, since I know I can't really see that impact in real time yet.
Thank you, Bob. So just a little bit more here before I move along. Does anybody have any commentary on what's been discussed so far before I jump us into the next set of topics?
Yeah, I will touch on this, and I will go the place a lot of people don't want to go. I do wonder, and this, you can call it conspiracy, call it whatever you want. The numbers, the last CPI has some really weird things going on it. And clearly, I will say it was not inflationary, but I do think that it's important to note that, like, you know, the last CPI number showed a decline of 18% in, you know, the cost of health insurance. You know, like, there's some really weird things going on under the hood that don't make a lot of sense. And if you look at the amount of funding has been cut to these CPI numbers in terms of to the board that does the CPI numbers, and dramatically higher amounts of estimates are having to be taken across the board. So I there's a lot of muddiness in general. I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, but, you know, but do know that there's some skepticism, healthy skepticism, that should be held as it relates to some of these numbers.
I'll just add quickly on that, to throw a little bit more red meat at that. I think it was UBS who put out a chart that just showed the number of sort of like manual revisions or like unusual calculations in CPI figures by month that showed a massive spike in the past one or two periods. So that's from at least a quasi reputable source.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be like nobody wanted to be, it didn't make sense to be a conspiracy theorist because it's so rare that conspiracies are a thing. But the reality is there are levers being pulled, and we have to be skeptical when appropriate.
Fair enough, guys. So I want to touch again a little bit on policy-related uncertainty, because that's sort of where Fed officials have, they've sort of flagged that as what's really weighing on growth in general. And so I'm curious here, as we've noted that container flows, especially U.S.-China container flows, are down by nearly half year over year. And there are some that are calling this a temporary time distortion. Some are calling it a structural decoupling that threatens long-term growth. My question is, if these numbers remain consistent, or far be it from me to say drop even further, could this tip us into a sort of supply-side recession? Joseph, I'd love your take here and then kick it around the panel on containers.
So I think there's a lot of things going on there. Like it's been discussed before, we had some front loading earlier, and now, you know, maybe they ordered too much. They don't need so much at the same time because they already pre-ordered that. So there's some volatility driven by policy and anticipation there. So I think it's really hard for me to read. But it seems like the administration's longer term or medium term strategy is to have some degree of decoupling with China. So to at least have certain industries in the US rather than in China. So that seems to be a policy driven thing. And yeah, if you are changing your supplier away from China to domestic suppliers, at least in the short run, that's going to have an impact on inflation. Now, we're discussing how goods inflation, you know, doesn't seem to be fully showing up, but it seems like it is a little bit. I think Anna Wan on Bloomberg has a really good view, whereas the CPI or any inflation index is going to be services weighted. So even though tariffs could have some impact on the good side of it, on the labor side, that's, as we know, gradually weakening. And so that seems to be overriding the inflation we see in the goods, so that such that the overall index just doesn't really seem to be going up. Now, one other thing that I think is worth noting is that, and as Lasper noted, we have weakness in housing. But because we have big changes in immigration policy, we used to have 2 million people, 3 million people coming in last year during Biden's term. And as Jim noted, that's not really happening anymore. That's a lot less demand for rentals, and that's going to put downward pressure on shelter as well. So it's really a mixed bag. And just like the Fed is saying, it's hard to read. So I'm not really sure how this container thing will turn out.
Fair enough, Joseph. Thank you. Does anybody have anything to add to Joseph's points on the containers issue?
I just wanted to highlight a really great article that Joseph Politano put out in the past couple of days that shows a lot of interesting data on imports and exports and how they've trended in the past couple months as it relates to tariffs. I would just note that on the container data, a lot of the stuff that we saw, especially in April and May, I think a lot of that was sort of high frequency, highly volatile, like weekly series. And I think probably the overall numbers are a little bit less extreme than what we've seen. But at the same time, like I said, if you take a look at this recent post by Joseph, it shows that there have been sort of consistent material declines, not just from China, but things like car imports that come from a lot of different countries, as well as U.S. exports to other countries as well. So there is, even if there haven't been sort of reciprocal or kind of counterbalancing tariffs from other countries, there have been. It does impact U.S. exports as well. So I think that probably the overall trend is maybe a little bit less extreme than some of the, more headline catching numbers have been. But at the same time, the general trend directionally is towards lower imports and lower exports.
I agree. Not directly. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I also endorse that, that post from him. It's an excellent, you guys should all read it. One of the things I would highlight is we're kind of talking about the Fed in a holding pattern. For a lot of onshore sellers, they too are in a holding pattern, in the sense of, many have tried to build up their inventories, and in some ways they're actually in an okay circumstance because they're getting a little bit of pricing. And, they paid for their existing inventory before the tariffs were in place. And so they're basically, they're basically on pause, to some extent, on their imported goods. And you see that even in the tariff, the weighted average tariff number and the imports numbers are down a lot. And so that's okay. They can handle that. But most businesses, they're probably holding, 2, 3, 4 months of inventory, maybe 6 months of inventory that they can draw down on. But which means that the rubber is not meeting the road, either on the pricing side or on the growth side. And so the whole story with the tariff impact, it's not really about the tariffs in any one moment. It's about the sort of ongoing sag on the economy or ongoing push on prices that exists with the tariffs that, every day that we are sort of in this period where tariffs remain elevated. Remember, even though there's a pause, the effective tariff rate is still 17.5% right now. That it becomes a greater impact on the economy, whether it's on prices, economic conditions, et cetera. And so we're probably 3 months away from it being a really significant, creating a lot of significant pain points across the economy.
Yeah, and that's that muddiness, right? And it's not just like a lag, which I agree with Bob completely. There is a massive lag here because of the pull forward. But it's actually, as we all know, right? If you pull forward demand now, that means less later. So it can really create almost like this zigzag to the numbers. And so really hard to kind of develop a trend based on kind of disruptions, right? Like what we're seeing here. There aren't many kind of precedents for this in recent history. I will say one thing there is, just to kind of shift gears here slightly, is one thing there is precedent for is Federal Reserve kind of taking the Federal Reserve into and under the administration, right? Like disrupting the independence of the Fed. And obviously, we've talked about the similarities to Nixon here in this administration before. But I do want to just, not enough people are talking about kind of, very similar timeline, 1 year, into about the first year of his administration. Nixon was at loggerheads with William McChesney Martin. And William McChesney Martin had been the Fed chair for over 15 years, a well-respected, independent voice, held the line, was worried about inflation, wasn't cutting the way Nixon wanted to, and he got pulled. And in January of 1970, he was replaced with Arthur Burns. Arthur Burns was a very, very close friend of Nixon, trusted source. I don't think it's a surprise, by the way, that Bessent is now the conversation for the next Fed chair. That he, you know, Trump is going to want the person he can most trust to carry out his goals here. And ironically, the real inflation wasn't that bad yet, right at that point. It's when Arthur Burns came in response to a decline in the market, started stimulating and pulling the Federal Reserve kind of stimulus, you know, card, that inflation really took off. And so I encourage people to go take a look at that. I think the general view of people is, oh, once the Fed comes into the fray, they are going to take down the 10-year bond, that they are going to control this this expansion of rates at the end of the curve. And I think what people don't realize is that if you do that, ultimately you take real rates from positive to negative or flat, you are going to accelerate the inflationary effects. And I think that steepener trade, which we've talked about now for years, which has been an incredible trade, will continue to be the most probable home run trade there is out there. The Fed will lower rates, but I think if you think that's going to lower the long end of the curve in any meaningful way for any amount of reasonable amount of time, that's something to watch very closely. We've seen historic precedent of what's happening here, and I think all the conversation about the shadow Fed and the moving of the Federal Reserve under removing its essential independence, I think, is an important conversation.
I actually would like to touch that briefly here if we can, and I'm going to pick on Joseph for this. How do you feel about some of what Jem said there, especially in regard to that notion of the Fed independence from, say, overreach in procedural decisions from the executive branch, Joseph?
I think Unusual Wells posted a good clip today of the president this morning, suggesting, maybe I'll just appoint myself Fed, right? Let's just skip the middleman. After all, you only need to go to the office once a month, right? It's like the easiest job. So I think this is something that we definitely need to think about. Like Jim mentioned, we have huge systemic changes in the world, geopolitically, but also within our country. If you look at what the administration is doing, it looks to me like some sort of counter-revolution, right? We're kind of changing the universities, changing law enforcement, changing everything. And so this is definitely something that could be subject to change as well. And Trump has been saying that he would like lower rates for some time. Looking at Twitter, it looks like the housing minister guy, Pulte, is also wanting lower rates as well. So Trump is eventually, he's going to get his Fed chair. I don't know who it is. It could be Bessent. It could be Kevin Hassett. But whoever it is, it's going to be his guy. And he's going to get his lower rates. And I don't think that's really priced into the market. Something else that I would note is that the Fed is a dual mandate bank, right? So there is full employment and price stability. But how they balance this is really up to them. And it's because you have this ambiguity here that you could easily have a central bank that cuts rates in the name of, trying to solve unemployment. It's totally justified. It would be within their right, but it's because their dual mandate gives them this leeway. Now, Bob made a really interesting comment that, Chair Powell has been failing his job for 50 months. Why is he still there earlier? Well, I think that kind of tells you something about the reaction function of the Fed. It's going to be labor over inflation, and every chair, every Fed is going to balance that differently. It's very clear how the future Trump-appointed Fed will balance this. And this is also in part due to the culture of our time. And that was the same problem that Arthur Burns had when he was Fed chair back a few decades ago. So like Jim mentions often, it's populism. And this is the logical conclusion from a Fed policy standpoint.
Bob, I see your hand there.
I think it's very interesting from a market participant perspective how little pricing there is of a hyper dovish new Fed chairman. The curve basically, if you look at the curve, what's priced in terms of short rates, like you basically have a gradual reduction in short rates priced in where Powell Fed doesn't look much different in terms of the pace of cuts than does the whoever's coming in new. Let's just say that. The Trump Fed. Maybe Trump himself, as you said. And so that's interesting to me why the market isn't pricing that much. There's an article in Bloomberg today talking about like the contracts, the silver contracts 1 month before or one quarter before, one quarter after the new person gets put in, but they're moving like 6 basis points, you know? And if the new administration is really committed to easy monetary policy, it seems like the short rate market is just not capturing that sufficiently right now at all. I'd be interested if anyone has thoughts on why that is, because it surprises me.
Last spare gem, do you have anything to add to what Bob added before I move us along? Because I do want to talk a little bit about bonds and assets as well. So the 10-year U.S. Treasury, our favorite little chart here, kind of recently made, in the last month or two, it spiked as high as like 4.8%. It recently again spiked to around 4.4, 4.5. And some speculate this is in large part investors trying to seek safety in, as many have called it, kind of mud clear waters for what's going to happen moving forward in terms of policy. And so I'm curious, does these spikes in the 10-year at all signal some kind of regime shift where fixed income starts outperforming equities as kind of their store of wealth, so to speak? Jim, I'd love your take on that one.
I mean, there is a ton of, if you go look at, I don't actually have the data in front of me, but if you look at the positioning right now in kind of interest rate, kind of SOFR markets, everybody is preparing for the Fed to, under a shadow Fed, start cutting, right? That this is kind of a temporary hold. So institutions are preparing for that. I do think that usually when everybody is on one side of the ball, like it tends to reflexively not work out how all the institutions seem to think. I do think, yes, they'll cut in front of the curve. So for, not today, by the way, but like, I think increasingly the pressure from the government, especially if this market declines, which I do still think that there is a higher probability than people expect. I do think that eventually the pressure that Trump is putting on the Fed will cause the Fed to cut. But I do think the effects on the 10-year will be, as we saw, by the way, we've seen multiple times now, in the market at the lows, the 10-year bond was actually kind of, the yield was going higher, right? And so I do think that there, most recently on the Israel bombing of Iran, like, we didn't see a flight to safety in the 10-year, right? We saw actually people pricing in instead the inflationary impact of increases in oil. And so I think the clues are there. The clues are there. I think this, like I said at the top of this conversation, the general overarching view and the positioning as a result of that overarching view that Trump will get his way and that the Fed will come to the rescue and that they will control the 10-year and the long end of the curve, that they're big enough. I'm willing to bet that does not. That does not come to pass as easily as people think. And again, I'll highlight that Nixon era, even with Arthur Burns cutting into a market decline, the market actually had its biggest legs lower in that process while that was happening. Yes, eventually that did stimulate enough to lower the front end and the middle of the curve. But it eventually took CPI then a lot higher into the market rally and markets rallied off a much lower number, I encourage people to go look at that history. Market rallied off a much lower level with stimulus and inflation, and the 10-year yields spiked in line with the market. So I expect more of that type of action. And I think if people are thinking, oh, well, we're going to get some earnings, recessionary massive collapse in growth, and that's going to create a flight to quality, to the 10-year. If you're still playing that game, I think you're missing the big picture, because that hasn't worked now in years, and I don't think it's going to work this time either.
Thank you, Jim. Does anyone have anything to add before I ask a little bit about foreign purchases of treasuries?
Yeah, I would just add that it's interesting if you the question of how the curve is reacting. I think it's really interesting where you look at the curve. So in particular, the very long end, 30-year rates, if you look at that chart, you don't see any sort of thing that shows confidence in long-term inflation expectations over a very long period of time, whereas shorter term rates, which obviously are much more policy driven and much more up to the things like who's going to be the Fed chair next year, look sort of much more in line. So I think it is interesting that the very long end has not bought a disinflationary narrative at this point. And I think that probably has to go to more of the structural long term issues, things that that Jim has talked about at length here on these spaces around entitlements, but some of the more big categories of spending in the federal budget that are just a whole lot harder to move and are moving in the wrong direction.
Also, I'll note that this is a global problem, right? We were talking about issues with longer dated Japanese bond yields as well. But also note that the Ministry of Finance over there was able to solve the problem by pulling a Yellen and shifting its composition of issuance towards shorter dated. So when you think about these sovereign financing things, they have many, many tools in their toolkit, not just changing issuance, but tweaking the regs for banks, or at the end of the day, having the central bank step in. So from my perspective, the weak point is going to be the currency rather than the rates market, because that's the segment of the market where there are not as many easy tools to solve.
Yeah, I actually think that's a critical point we haven't talked about, the dollar, right? I think, obviously this dollar weakness we've seen, that's the other element that, that's pretty inflationary, right? Like, we'll take tariffs and everything else out of the picture, and, a 10% move in your currency, in theory, you're not going to pass through all 10% of that cost, but that should be a meaningful cost increase for imports. Think of that as another increase of 5% in tariffs. So I think that's a critical thing that very few people are talking enough about. And then separately, I think there's some, I don't want to get too much into the math here, but I do want to highlight, I want people to dig in a little bit and look at, you can look at Japanese yields in yen, and then you can look at US yields in dollars. And, if you look at them kind of without looking at the currency piece, you're like, well, yeah, as an American, I'd much rather own kind of the dollar, the 10-year, right? I get a higher yield given the risk, et cetera. Maybe that's your thought process. But if you go play the currency curve and lock in, dollar versus yen, and do that versus the 3.5 or whatever yield and long dated, Japanese debt, you're actually getting a much higher return in dollars. So I think there are much bigger opportunities, especially given the fiscal situation, to be in other currencies and get higher yield in dollars if you play the FX market. So there's structural effects here that actually make the 10-year in the US very undesirable relative to other yields. And that has got to close. That gap has got to close by either yields going higher at the long end of the curve in the US, or the currency continue to come down basically, and those curves to normalize. And one of the two needs to happen. Otherwise, the risk return doesn't make sense. And so I encourage people to go look at the long end of the curve and kind of understand those dynamics and the importance of the currency in that picture.
And as Joseph noted, one of the things to keep in mind is the debt problem is a global developed world plus China problem. And given that's the case, basically future money across all those economies, which is just what bonds are, is just going to have a bad return relative to real assets. And, you know, and in particular, you know, currencies might jockey against each other. I agree with some of the points that Jem is making about why the U.S. is looking particularly unattractive right now and from a yield perspective. And then also, if you just look at the level of the currency, we're still not that far off of long-term highs on the dollar relative to other major currencies. But all of those moves are likely to be modest relative to hard assets. The move of fiat currencies relative to hard assets and the move of fiat bonds in developed, overly indebted developed economies relative to hard assets. And so I think people look at gold and they're like, yeah, it's up a lot, which, you know, it is up a lot. Somehow when gold's up a lot, everyone starts to raise a question about it. When Bitcoin's up a lot, everyone is all into it. But, you know, I think gold in particular, it is the contra currency, you know, for a long time. And the sort of more secular dynamic is the sort of thing that could easily continue to put pressure for gold to push higher, you know, even though it is up quite a bit.
So kind of on that note, one thing that's been noticeable in terms of treasuries is that Japan specifically has been kind of increasing U.S. treasury purchases while China, which has already been mentioned, has paused. And kind of to what Bob said there in terms of where are we in terms currently of global confidence in the U.S. debt, or even the potential geopolitical concerns that surround them? Are we seeing any kind of increases or decreases outside of Japan's increase and China's decrease? Last Bear, any idea?
Yeah, I think that the point, I think that you can, the market will equalize for these sort of things. I think Bob was just sort of mentioning, you know, hard assets versus fiat. And I think that that's a great point where whether you're talking about gold or Bitcoin or housing or you know, whatever it is, things that sort of are more rooted are going to have higher returns than something that's sort of mechanically falling into a process that's really hard to reverse. And so I think what you see is, you know, you can look at the different global, you know, developed country sovereign debts and sort of compare which ones, you know, which one's good, which one's bad, but you're kind of, you know, they're all of the same category in a lot of respects. And so I don't think it's, you know, I do think that you see central banks like China, you know, looking at gold and buying gold. I think that as, you know, even as we've seen with stablecoin regulation in the U.S. continuing to legitimize cryptocurrencies as a legitimate framework for financial flows that can only sort of benefit that ecosystem as well. I think that that really what you're talking about, I think, as Bob mentioned, is a global problem where maybe one block is better than the other, one house is better than the other one, but they're sort of all in the same block.
Thank you, Last Bear. Joseph, I'm curious if you have anything to add there on treasuries and global confidence in them while we have these 7 or so minutes until we get some numbers.
Yeah, so, you know, treasuries are, you know, in recent history have been a global safe haven, right? For foreign investors, for everyone. So if something bad happens in the world, what tends to happen is the dollar tends to appreciate and the market tends to price in rate cuts from the Fed. So if you're holding treasury securities, that's great, right? From a foreign investor perspective, gain the appreciation from the dollar. And also because of the interest rate sensitivity, you would also be doing well there. Now, like Jim mentioned, over the past couple of months, we've seen some really strange things happen in the market, particularly in that week after Liberation Day, where everything sold off, dollar sold off, treasury sold off. What didn't sell off was gold, right? Gold seems to be the one true global safe haven. It's hard assets, basically, like the last speaker mentioned. So I think this is something that is a world that we're gradually shifting into. It's all fiat currency. Everyone has, all developed markets have this debt problem, as Bob mentioned. And so it seems like the market is gradually converging towards maybe gold as something that's safer. And I don't expect this to happen overnight. It's going to be a process. We're changing entire zeitgeist that dominated the world for decades into this new era that we're heading into. When I look at the data for foreign treasury purchases over the past few years, I think foreigners have been on net a pretty large purchasers of treasury coupons. So we don't have the latest data yet, but I would expect that they would reevaluate their views of treasury securities given what they saw in April, and given, I think, the perception that U.S. policy is somewhat more volatile. And of course, we have a very large fiscal deficit problem. So we'll find out more as we get more data. But I think things are changing. But again, these are conservative, slow-moving institutions, and we're changing a zeitgeist that's existed for decades. So it's going to be a process. It's not going to be something that just shifts within a few weeks.
Thank you, Joseph. Now, on that topic of a shift, actually, but in line with equities rather than bonds, obviously with equities, the volatility is, you know, it seems to be pretty alive and well. I mean, while we've been talking, I just watched the NASDAQ rip straight down 100 points and right back up in a few minutes there. Hopefully the craziest swings are behind us for now, at least. But one question we've asked on these panels in years prior that might have a bit more context now lies with that somewhat traditional 60-40 strategy, and some still swear by it, but larger funds have seemingly begun to pivot away from it. And Jim, you recently discussed this on Top Traders Live. Is the 60-40 dead in the water, and when should people start kind of stepping away from that strategy if it is?
Oh, now you're throwing me a meatball. That's too easy. No, yeah. I mean, look, simple math for everybody on here who hasn't heard it from me before. You know, the number one lesson in finance that everybody learns, that everybody just seemingly forgets, is that the discount rate is the denominator. That the long-term interest rate is the denominator. And you know, if interest rates go from 2 to 4%, you know, your valuation gets cut in half. In 1968 to, you know, 1982, we've talked about this period, 14 years, perfect analogy, 22 price to earnings ratio in the S&P 500, about a 4% 10-year. That makes sense, right? That's where we are now, by the way. Does that sound familiar? Guess what? In 1982, with the 10-year bond trading 20%, the price to earnings ratio of the S&P 500, wait for it, was 4.5. The price to earnings ratio of the S&P 500 in 1982 was 4.5. That blows people's minds, but it makes complete sense. The inverse of the price to earnings ratio is the earnings yield. And if you're not making a higher earnings yield than the guaranteed yield you're going to get from the U.S. government for 10 years, you are not going to buy it. It's that simple. And so, yes, you need, if the 10-year bond, this is what the work of, you know, Robert Shiller is all about. And yes, there are long and variable yields. CAPE is not a market timing mechanism, but guess what? With a lag, and now we've been at, you know, these rates now for you know, increasingly to these levels over the last 4 or 5 years. Everybody refinanced in 2021, 2020, and the average duration of debt taken during, you know, during that time is 5 to 7 years. Okay, guess what? That bill is coming due, and we don't need yields to go higher for that yield, that bill in terms of supply and demand to come due. But, you know, 5 years from 2021, early 2021 puts us at early next year. And that is, you're starting to see bankruptcies increase, tick up significantly. It's not linear. It's increasing quite quickly. You're starting to see a massive amount of both in commercial real estate, you know, non-investment grade debt. We can go through all the private equity, all of the refinancing that needs to happen is coming onto market. And it's not a cliff, but it is increasing dramatically. And it remains very high and increasing from year five, from now till 2 years from now. And that is how this rebalancing happens. So if you're asking me about timing, yeah. Yeah, you don't want to be, these are record valuations or near them, given how high interest rates are. And if there's a risk, we don't have to say it's a definite thing, but if there's a risk of yield staying here or going higher, good luck in 60-40. Again, the precedent is not good, especially given the macro and geopolitical concerns we've all highlighted here. You are taking massive risk without the return. In the words of Warren Buffett, you know, nobody knows who's swimming naked till the tide goes out. I'm here to tell you the tide's going out. You better get a swimsuit. Otherwise, there aren't many swimsuits left. So 60-40, by the way, take out, if you include the last 40 years, you look at 125 years of history, big picture. You don't just look at the period where interest rates went top left to bottom right from 20 to zero. You look at the full 125-year history, the Sharpe ratio of the S&P 500 is 0.31. The Sharpe ratio of 60-40 is 0.44. Those are awful. Okay, so yes, we've had outperformance the last 40 years, closer to a 0.8 Sharpe for S&P 500. And with a 60-40 portfolio, close just over one. Awful. 60-40 is not a new innovation. The reason people do it is because of recency bias, because for 40 years, interest rates went top left to bottom right. And the assumption is that will continue. You're confusing causation from correlation. The reality is interest rates going lower is what drove that. And if interest rates go higher, especially here with a lag, the opposite will happen. So I'll leave it there.
Thank you much, Jim. A really good breakdown there. Now, surprising no one, the Federal Reserve has not cut rates. They're going to keep those the same. And I do have a follow-up to some of Jim's discussion there. But first, I want to let the panelists have a moment here to kind of go over the drop, go over the dot plots, and see if we find any tasty tidbits in there.
On first blush, it looks somewhat stagflationary, right? They revised up their inflation forecast a little bit. We revised up their unemployment rate a little bit. So, I mean, that's not good, but my read is that the Fed tends to value employment more than inflation. So we still have these two cuts. In any case, guys, after Border Flight, it was really nice discussing. Talk to you guys next time.
Always love having you here, Joseph. Thank you.
I have to run too, guys. Best of luck. Feel free to reach out next time. We'll do it again.
Sounds great, guys. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so I would add that the... Go ahead, Nick.
I was just going to say that the commentary on economic uncertainty, the outlook, diminished but remains elevated. And I was curious what you think they meant by that.
Probably the flip-flop on tariffs, I guess, is probably what they're suggesting there, which I think is a fair point, that it does seem that policy has moderated from a pretty extreme outlook, maybe 2 months ago. I think the last FOMC was right at the beginning of May. So that was sort of still in the peak of the inflation and, tariff fears. And it does really seem that the administration has gone from being, I think I put it before Trump went from being a stock puncher to a stock pusher. And it doesn't seem like that perspective has changed all that much for the time being, at least.
And it kind of looks like the median dot pretty well unchanged at two cuts, kind of barely there. But it looks like seven who penciled in no cuts at all. Is this kind of showing some kind of shift here, Bob? What do you think?
Sorry, just took a minute to unmute. This is reflecting a lot of uncertainty about what's likely to occur. I think that's what, you know, I think the economic projections, I mean, first of all, let's all remember that the Fed has no ability to predict what's likely to transpire in the economy. So I guess probably shouldn't really focus on those too much since they're, pretty random. But I think they definitely are pointing towards a more stagflationary environment in terms of, you know, how they're penciling it out with higher core inflation, lower real GDP growth, and a higher unemployment rate over the course of, you know, relative to where they were in the period before. I think, you know, the policy projections are basically not changing much because they don't really know which way it'll break. And my guess is we're probably seeing in amongst the dots a set of folks who are more concerned about the employment situation and some that are more concerned about inflation. And so therefore what you're getting is you're getting sort of a combination, sort of outsized unemployment numbers, outsized inflation numbers, and kind of the netting out of the dots being roughly the same.
Thank you, Bob. Last Bear, do you have anything else to comment on that report before I start picking your brains again?
No, I would just add that I think that the medians moved a little bit in the ways that folks described. It looks like the broader ranges actually haven't changed hardly at all. So I think, you know, it's a little bit of over precision to try to glean too much from a median number when the general perspective hasn't changed a whole lot. And I don't think that there's been a whole lot in the past month and a half that would change folks' view when you're looking at the employment data being sort of a little bit soft, but you know, still not showing significant degradation. You have inflation numbers that have generally beat people's expectations in terms of being lower than what people think. So it's not surprising. Obviously, the rate cut or lack of rate cut, not a surprise to anybody either. I think we're all waiting to see. And I think, you know, the topic that we haven't touched on yet is how geopolitics sort of fit into this. But I can't help but think that, you know, Trump coming out every single day, being so aggressive about his own perspective about the need for rate cuts is either consciously or subconsciously influencing FOMC members and sort of just instinctually pushing back on that, whether or not that's a good idea from an independent perspective.
Thank you, Last Bear. So go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I think one of the things kind of interesting, and my guess, you know, kind of it's connected to what I was talking about, which is I bet we're seeing multiple camps emerge within the Fed. Is just looking at the dot plot for 25, where you basically see a bunch of dots that, you know, are projecting, you know, basically no change, and a bunch of dots that are projecting a couple of cuts. And that's kind of interesting. I guess in some ways there's a more strategic question here over the next year, which is around Fed credibility, where, you know, one of the challenges as the Fed faces this uncertainty is, does the Fed itself start to pull at its own seams, which kind of undermines the overall credibility of the Fed. And anyway, that, you know, this is a small indication of the type of disagreements we're probably seeing around the table. But, you know, those disagreements are probably pretty real in terms of what's going on, and probably even, you know, even more extreme in terms of the disagreements is if you go all the way out to the end, to the longer run dots, you know, there's views ranging from the long-term rate being 2.5% to 4%. And that is a pretty remarkable range when you think about, you know, this group wrestling with, are the current rates conceptually neutral, or are they considerably restrictive? Or, I mean, I don't think anyone thinks they're super stimulative, but I think that's another spot where it feels like, you know, the Fed is exposing its meaningful internal disagreements with those dots.
So I want to touch a little bit more on that topic of equities and some of what Jem was saying about problems with debt given rates. Distressed corporate debt is up roughly 60%, I think it was, since April of this year. And I'm wondering, does that kind of indicate early warnings in the credit markets, as Jem was kind of alluding to, and kind of as a byproduct of that, kind of maybe seem like equities are a little too complacent maybe with everything going on? I'm curious your thought there, Last Bear. Are we getting kind of complacent here inequities during all of these news cycles that are hitting us?
I think that what we've seen in equities has been sort of a Jekyll and Hyde market for at least the past 6 months or so. I'd say going back to, you know, around the election, we saw sort of things get pretty euphoric. That's sort of, you know, that's certainly how we started the year, I'd say, through February. And then it seemed like political perspective, tariffs, policy changes really kind of took hold of the market. Obviously, the reaction to the Liberation Day was quite extreme, and you know, sentiment probably couldn't be much lower than it was in early April. And then just 6 weeks or 8 weeks later, you know, we're back to sort of to the euphoria stage of the market. So I think, you know, we kind of swung through these extremes, and it's really hard, you know, if you were to ask somebody in the beginning of April or in the middle of April, like what's your view on the stock market? And I think people would be very negative. I think if you ask them now, you know, they're thinking about 7,000 S&P. The reality is probably somewhere in between that. And it kind of is typical of, you know, of what we're seeing just broadly with the, you know, the speed and change and volatility in policy. And also I'd say the conflicting signals in the economy itself too, right? So it's interesting that obviously Trump as a former real estate developer, that the housing minister, he's a home builder himself. The idea of lower rates is sort of just a natural inclination. And so it makes sense why he's pushing for that as a policy. And I think you could also look at an economist perspective who's saying, hey, I actually am looking at weakening labor market to some extent. I'm looking at, you know, maybe underlying inflation, ex shelter, looking much more in line with where it should be from a target perspective, thinking about tariff risk and saying, hey, it's actually probably a pretty good time, you know, to cut right now as well. But I think it's just hard for anybody to say, especially with, you know, volatility in oil prices. I think since the last FOMC meeting, oil is up something like 25%. Granted, that was sort of pinpointing the lows at the prior FOMC. But obviously, we've seen in the past geopolitics, especially in the Middle East, have big influence on obviously the price of oil and the price of energy broadly. And that flows through the economy in a sort of omnipresent way. So I think everyone is sort of fluctuating between extremes. And we're really certainly not in an environment where it's clear to say, hey, things are just moving forward in a straightforward and natural manner. So it's I understand the Fed's predicament. Certainly, I understand the market's predicament in trying to predict it. So for now, I think from an equity perspective, what's been successful is to sort of try to understand these swings in sort of sentiment more than anything, and try to capture them.
Thank you, Last Bear. I want to curtail this a little bit into another market, that being the housing market. Last Bear mentioned earlier in the panel that May's housing starts came in quite a bit lower than projected. I think it was down 9.8% to 1.25 million. And that was a fairly big broad. Consensus was 0.8%, I think. And a lot of people are speculating the shadow of potential tariffs kind of overhanging at all times without any kind of real resolution on what's going to happen there being a pretty big factor there. But on top of that, we've got housing inventory up something like 30% year over year, with pending sales dropping down roughly 3%. And so I wonder, do these occurrences reflect a healthy normalization, or is it a start of us seeing a broader housing decline as we kind of go forward into the rest of the year?
So I can kick it off. So I think for U.S. housing, you first thing just to establish is that it depends on where you are. It's an incredibly bifurcated market at this point in time, much more so, I would say, even than, you know, prior housing booms, mid 2000s. What we see right now is inventory now blowing past not just, you know, the extreme lows that it was in maybe 2021, 2022, but even much higher than pre-COVID levels in certain markets like Sunbelt markets, Florida, Texas, Arizona, Utah. Sort of the big boom markets are really looking oversaturated from a supply perspective. And that's obviously also where, you know, prices have run up the most. And so what we are seeing now is, what seems to be the beginning of more serious declines or potential outright price declines in those markets. At the same time, if you look at places like the Northeast or the Midwest, inventory is still just brutally low, a fraction of what it was before COVID, and it really hasn't moved at all. And so housing prices in those markets are much more stable. So I think in order to look at the housing market overall, you really need to talk about exactly what you're talking about. I think that there is possibility for, for a potential material correction in some of the markets, like I mentioned, in the Sun Belt, Florida, Texas, Arizona. But in places like the Northeast, it's really hard to see that given where inventory is. And I think it's been interesting to watch this play out over the past 5 years or so, where there was a pretty significant decline in certain markets when rates first started hiking in 2022, but then that stabilized pretty quickly. But if you look at the inventory levels, they were still very low at that point. And so, yes, you had rate impacts, obviously taking a huge hit immediately, but the overall supply and dynamic was still very much in a seller's market. In a seller's market. I think that now we're in a position where it's not the case. You actually are very much oversupplied in those markets. And so the potential for sort of the next leg down is definitely there. And I think overall home builder, obviously their financial results, but also home builder sentiment overall has been very negative in the past couple of weeks or a couple of months. And so I think it's an interesting market to watch.
One of the things from my perspective, you just think about the GDP effect of what's going on here, is that the places where we're seeing the most acute softening were many of the places where we saw the greatest, essentially the greatest building, right? I mean, part of the reason why there's lots of places in the Northeast where, inventories are low and prices remain high is because you just can't build, right? They're either already built or there's, a lot of zoning restrictions, et cetera. Whereas, in other places, what we're seeing is almost like a very traditional cycle in the sense of, price, there's a lot of demand, prices rose, supply was created, the increase in supply starts to create a weight on prices, and prices fall, and the desire to create new supply starts to fade again. And so in some ways, the GDP impact of the Northeast, of the bifurcation, is really concentrated in the story of the weakness that we're seeing in the high supply areas. And so I think that's an important consideration, where, residential fixed investment was a bit of a help, both in terms of single family and multifamily, and that's going to fade just at a time when we're starting to see, household demand is also starting to fade. And so you've got basically the two most sort of cyclical parts of the economic conditions starting to fade, basically at the same time. That it's going to be tough to hold up end demand in a context of both of those fading.
I think I would be inclined to agree with both of you there. I got no arguments on either side. I'm wondering kind of to what you said there, Bob, in terms of household demand, consumer participation has been finally showing signs of dropping. And I think the last time I looked it up, the top 10% of earners were shelling out something crazy, like 80%+ of all consumer spending. But my question here is more in terms of labor in general, because the unemployment's been kind of staying more or less the same spot, just above 4%, but wage growth itself has kind of fallen flat. And so I wonder, in regards to housing as well, if payrolls begin to turn south, what kind of typical lead time before we see stress in mortgage delinquencies, home prices, or other factors that would really signal an issue?
Well, I think I'd probably separate the two different points, which is, one is from a GDP effect, the thing that really matters is household spending. Like, you kind of can't get around it. we talk about all sorts of other corners of the market, but household spending drives GDP. And if you look in the last couple of years, the big driver, big financing, quote unquote, of household spending has been rising household incomes. I think the challenge there is that has made, you know, the extension of the expansion really reliant on, you know, continued strength in the labor market. And for a variety of reasons, the labor market has softened, which has brought down wages, wage growth. You know, ECI has come down considerably and is now, you know, something like 3%, 3 to 3.5%. And the combination of immigration constraints plus, you know, slow hiring is, you know, really starting to hit the payroll side of things, where if you, let's say you adjust for what are probabilistically the payroll revisions plus the QCEW revisions, you know, we're probably running at roughly zero payroll growth right now. And so you look at those two things combined, wage growth per employee at about 3 and continuing to soften, and payroll growth at about 0, you add that up, that's 3% nominal income growth for households, you know, in a 2 to 3% inflation environment. That is a very tough story for the continued expansion of the U.S. economy. So far, you know, for a while there, it looked like household spending was holding up, but we're now starting to see some signs that it's starting to fade. And you know, whether it be the retail sales numbers, I mean, first quarter, you know, household consumption, real household consumption was soft, wasn't terrible, but it was softer than it had been in previous quarters. A lot of timely indicators are suggesting some softening of household demand. And so all of that is sort of, that picture is not a great, you know, leave the tariffs and the geopolitical risks and all that stuff aside. If we were just talking about this, we'd be saying, oh, look, the economy is, you know, starting to decelerate. And then we got all those other things that are not so helpful either. When it comes to mortgages and mortgage delinquencies, it really, ultimately, people keep paying their mortgage until the point where they lose their jobs. And so, you know, we're not there yet. We've got a ways to go. We can easily have a slow session where you don't have too much trouble in the housing market, particularly since so many people locked in low rates and have low debt levels. But we're not going to see 2008 and the subsequent effects of 2008 any, you know, likely in the housing market. But could growth be, you know, meaningfully softer than what's currently expected in the equity market? Yeah, I think we're on that path, even without, you know, the tariffs and the and some of the immigration problems.
Thank you, Bob. So I want to touch real quick. I know we don't have a ton of time and a little bit on me for waiting until the very end to bring it up, but it's definitely on a lot of people's minds. I want to avoid the political aspect as much as possible, just kind of looking at potential consequences of the current Israel-Iran conflict from kind of like a macro perspective. And the key factor I want to take a look at while we have about 8 minutes here before Powell's presser is that on oil. Following the latest strikes, Brent oil, as we all saw, spiked into a range of 7 and 11% to around 74 to 75 per barrel. And there's even concerns that Iran might attempt to close the Strait of Hormuz, which analysts warn could drive oil even higher into that 120, maybe even 130 range. And so I'm wondering, in terms of Fed policy, should the Fed regard oil as a kind of wild card due to the uncertainty? Or should they be heavily incorporating that aspect into their new projections? Last spare, I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I think, as you mentioned, we've already seen tangible impacts there, obviously the oil price itself. But, you know, we saw the what it turns out to be a collision in the Strait of Hormuz. It's unclear whether that was related to some of the GPS jamming, that sort of thing that has been documented as going on in that place, or whether it was just sort of a coincidental incident. But I think if you look at things like VLCC rates or, you know, tanker rates and insurance costs, like those have responded quite dramatically in the past week to the tensions that we've seen. I do think that there is just broadly a perception, like, you know, I was talking to a friend over the weekend, and the his perspective was looks like Israel wrapped up this war in 2 days, and that's great. We're on to the next thing. But, you know, I look back at the fact that the U.S. Spent 3 or 4 weeks bombing the heck out of the Houthis in Yemen, and yet the Red Sea is still not fully open for commercial travel. We see, even if there haven't been sort of a strict blockade or mining of the Strait of Hormuz, we see implications in the tanker market. We see obviously oil prices reacting pretty strongly to those sort of events. And so I think, you know, I think it would be unwise to expect that this is going to be a conflict that's ending, you know, tomorrow or sometime in the immediate future. I think that what we've seen over and over is that these things tend to drag out for an extended period of time. And we've already seen some impact in terms of macroeconomic implications of it. So I think it's a real risk as to how the Fed deals with it. I think that they need to take it into their outlook, and I think that they are. It's impossible. You know, Brent prices are, or oil prices are, what they are. And to the extent that oil prices are reacting to these sort of moves, it increases costs for energy, and that's a big factor in the economy. So whether or not the Fed reacts to that with rate cuts or not, or look at it from an inflationary perspective, I think it just adds to uncertainty. And again, as we've sort of laid out over and over in this conversation, there's just so much uncertainty and things tugging in different directions that the clear path for right now is to do nothing and wait for some more clarity. So I think that's what we see.
Fair enough. Thank you, Les Vares. So kind of like just in line with that, some strategists argue that markets are shrugging this conflict off in a lot of ways. We did see, you know, intraday moves were down off of highs again, but I mean, it doesn't really seem to me, at least, that we've had a major market reaction to what's happening at this time. And so I wonder, Bob, from your perspective, is that complacency or, you know, some form of misguided confidence that the conflict won't spread into a wider energy disruption?
Well, I think part of it is probably, you know, projecting that that this isn't going to spread into a wider, let's say, set of conflicts. So just a very simple example is, you know, whether the U.S. gets drawn in. There's some commentary from the Russians today that if the U.S. Gets drawn in or engages, that they may engage as well, you know, at a strategic level. If we, you know, if Iran is the flashpoint for a more significant global conflict, the kinetic wars, then, you know, the markets are radically mispricing the second and third order consequences of that. I think sort of pushing that to the side, if you look at how they're responding, how the markets are responding to this particular circumstance, the reality is an oil price shock in the U.S. today is pretty different than it was like back in the 70s. Couple important reasons. One is the amount of consumption, you know, the share of our consumption that is taken up by oil today is a lot lower than it was, about a quarter to a fifth of what it was back in that period. So just price movements have less of an economic effect. And then, of course, from the U.S. growth perspective, you know, the U.S. is now a net exporter of petroleum products. And that's a pretty important consideration because it means that, you know, while some consumers will get hit with higher oil prices, there's also, you know, people working on the rigs that are likely to experience better incomes. And so there's a balance there, much more balanced impact. It's not really the case for Europe or Japan, where they have mostly a net negative impact. And so I think also what we're seeing is sort of a recognition that, you know, an oil price shock is not great, but it's not nearly as terrible as you might have thought, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And so the real mispricing, the more strategic mispricing, is that there's not going to be a greater, or I don't know if mispricing, but the markets are certainly pricing in that there's essentially no chance of a greater global conflict started or sparked by the Iran-Israel conflict. And, you know, I'm not a geopolitical expert, but pricing that at zero seems imprudent, I'd say.
Fair enough. I don't know if I would have the gall. I think we got a lot of learning done today. I learned a lot, and it's given me a lot to look forward to as we kind of move forward throughout the year. And I'm curious to see how the next FOMC goes as well. But for now, everybody, if you're not following the folks that were up here today, especially Bob and Les Vares here with us currently, do so. They put out a ton of information, a lot of education, and really good takes on what's happening, be it individual tickers or macroeconomics.